Okay, we're doing a Chumash here on a Friday morning, Parsha Shemot. And questions being raised that when Moshe intervened to save the Jew who was being beaten by the Mitzri, by the Egyptian, and word got out. That's a very interesting idea in its own right. How did anybody find out about it? So word got out, and the pasuk says, "Vayishma Paro as a davar hazeh," and Paro heard about this. "Vayivakeish laharog es Moshe," and he sought to kill Moshe. "Vayivrach Moshe mibnei Paro," and Moshe ran away from Paro. "Vayeshev v'yaretz Midyan," "Vayeshev al ha'be'er," and he dwelled in the land of Midyan, and he dwelled by the be'er. Now the question is being raised, why did Paro seek to kill Moshe, and why didn't he seek rather to overlook it and protect Moshe, given that that Moshe was raised in his house? Moshe was basically, in a sense, like a child of Paro, it would seem. Well, certainly his daughter's child, she was the adopted mother. But the Rashi points out in Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says twice, Vayigdal. That is, leading up to the event, after it tells you that Moshe was weaned, and then Vayigdal Hayelad, and the boy grew up, Vatviel Bas Paro, and they brought him to the daughter of Paro, Vahila Levain. That's very important. Vahila Levain means that the relationship took hold. He was a son. Vatikra Shema Moshe, and she called his name Moshe. Vatomer Kimina Mayim Shisihu, because I pulled him out of the water. Then it says, so that's the first time that he was Vayigdal. Then it says, Vahiba Yom Mehem. It was in those days. Now that's already a reference to the situation of the enslavement. Vayigdal Moshe Vayetzi Alechav. Another Vayigdal. And Moshe grew up and he went out to his brethren and he saw them in their labors. Now Rashi picks up on the double Vayigdal and he says, Vayigdal Moshe Valo Kfar Ksiv Vayigdal Hayeled. And it already says that the lad, the child, grew up. Amar Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Eloi. Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Eloi said, Harishon l'kuma. The first one is, kuma would seem to be physical. He matured physically. Vasheni l'gdula. The second Vayigdal is gedula. Means a position of power. Shemonhu Paro al Beso. Paro appointed him over his house. So this would support the idea that Paro had given Moshe authority and power. And the question is being raised, if so, why wouldn't he seek to protect Moshe? All right, I'll seek to maybe, I think this recalls for some speculation. I'm curious about the Midrash, though. What is it that caused him to make this statement? That is, this is a Midrash, it's not a fact that's recorded, Vayigdal, because it says Vayigdal. What's the plain shot of Vayigdal? I don't think that the Midrash that Rashi cites, Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Eloi, I don't think that's the plain shot.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up.
The question is, what does he mean by this? That is, the real question, I think, should be, what is the meaning of Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Eloi? Why is he forced to say this? Or what's he trying to say? The fact that it says Vayigdal twice doesn't necessarily mean that the second one was for Gedula. The way I think the Ramban learns it, let's take a look at the Ramban. Vayigdal Moshe Vayetzi Alechav Shegodal Vahayla Ish. The first one, I'm sorry, this is the second one, means that he became a man. Ki mitchila amar vayigdal hayeled. If you take a look at this, The first time it says Vayigdal Hayeled, the Torah is very exact. The second time it says Vayigdal Moshe. So what's the difference? The first one is Vayigdal Hayeled Shegidel Ad Shelo Yitzarch Lagamla Oso. That is, he matured. The first one with reference to the weaning process. So he grew up means he was no longer a baby that had to be weaned. V'yaz heviyasul basparo. And then she brought him, I guess it was Miriam, or the mother, or Yocheved, the one who had agreed to wean him. Then she brought him to the house of Paro. V'hilo levein. Ah, so he became a son to her. Because he sat before kings. That was part of the Ashkacha, that Moshe should grow up in a royal situation. That's a very important idea as well. You see, the Torah is making a point about that. That Moshe was never subjugated. He was never subjected to the enslavement. He never partook of that slave mentality. And to the contrary, he was raised in the house of the king, and thus given access to all of the wisdom, all of the learning, all of the knowledge. V'yachrechein gadal v'yiyaliyish das. So the second one means, it makes sense. The first one is v'yigdal hayeled. It's talking about the development of a child. And it's clear from the pasuk that it only means to say that he no longer had to be weaned. So now he could be separated from his true mother. And then he was brought to the daughter of Pharaoh and became like a son. Then, in the house of Pharaoh, he grew up and became an independent person. And he went out to check on the situation, to see. So, that's the plain shot. There's no need to say that the second Vayigdal is a reference to Gedula. Indeed, if that were the pshat, the Torah would have made it clear. So, the question really is, what is he saying over here? Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, what's forcing him to say it, and what's the point that he's trying to make? I think Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai is basing himself on the fact that the Torah is pointing at something. You could explain both by Yigdals, but they're really not that necessary. For example, the first one, that's to tell you that he was weaned by his mother and then they kept their agreement and he was brought to the house of fire. All that's necessary. The second by Yigdal is really not that necessary. Because once you know that he went out and he encountered the situation and he acted, so it's obvious that he's not a child anymore. So the second one is basically telling you that, but there's something a little superfluous, and that's why he's using it as a medrash. It's trying to tell you something. Now, it's an interesting phenomenon that Moshe presented a bit of a problem for Paro. That's very, very interesting. Because the whole policy of Paro was against the Jews. And thus, every child that is born, every male that is born, cast them into the water, and so on and so forth. And there's Rashis that say that the astrologers of Egypt predicted that the savior of the Jews would be born, and so on and so forth. However you want to take them, it's clear that Paro had to view the situation with ambivalence. This child, to all intents and purposes, should have been killed. He was only saved because of the daughter. She had taken pity on Moshe. That was a very important factor. Vine nar boche, and she had mercy on him, and she took him, and so on and so forth. But this was against the official policy. And we don't know how she got around that. Now, it's clear that her father knew. So he was in a very unusual position. Here he was, that he was, he had a policy to get rid of all of the Jews, because they constituted nothing but a threat. And they were the enemy, and they were hated. And here it is that he's raising this person who's a Jew in his own house. So that's a big problem, I would imagine. among his ministers, his servants, and so on. I don't know what the situation is vis-a-vis public opinion in those days, but that's clearly not a good position. Thus, perhaps, well, on the one level, it's his daughter, but that's not a justification for the people. When he saw the abilities, this is an irony. This is an ironic kind of a thing that even the worst anti-Semites very often recognized the abilities of the Jews, the capabilities of the Jews, and if they were able to control their anti-Semitism, they would benefit. Someone, for example, like Nixon, I don't want to speak badly about him, but he was considered to be, on a personal level, to have anti-Semitic feeling. I mean, look, Roosevelt or even Truman, on a personal level, they may have had anti-Semitic feelings. But practically speaking, for example, someone like Kissinger, his leading advisor was Henry Kissinger and other Jews. So the fact that he recognizes the abilities of Moshe, that's something that we encounter throughout history. Now, perhaps in doing so, he wanted to remove any stigma. That is, it's always the... Well, you see, the Germans also had that that tendency to use the Jews against the Jews. The capos, or the ones in the ghettos, they would appoint leaders amongst the Jews and get them to do the dirty work as much as possible. So that... Having, although it doesn't say over here, I don't know. I mean, he appointed him over his house. What his ultimate objective was, we don't know. But if we are to say that Paro did this because he wanted to demonstrate that Moshe was an exception and that Moshe accepted the policy and that he would be a great boon for Egypt. Interestingly enough, that idea that the Jews, when they had first come down, had been a great boon for Egypt, that he'd be another Yosef, say, someone who would be a hero for Egypt. And if he was part of the policy, then certainly it would strengthen it. So however, when Yosef, when Moshe rather, went out and he slew the Egyptian, so then, to the contrary, then Paro had to take action against him. Not to take action against him would mean that he's absolutely in contradiction. He's weak. How would you? He'd be a fool. He'd be a fool. He brought in a... Then he'd be a total fool. The question is, bringing in this Jewish child and raising him and giving him all the benefits and everything, that's the Vayigdal. So he was grooming him for a purpose, which would be for the sake of Egypt. This way he could justify it. He could justify what he did. But if it turns out that this person is a Jew, and he's remaining loyal to his brethren, and he's opposing the policy, then he has to get rid of him. Then he's an enemy. And to tolerate him any further... A, it would be dangerous, and he'd be a real fool for having appointed him in the first place. It makes sense to say that the Paro would have to know the background. That everybody knew that. That wasn't a secret. It says, Venaros Holchos al Sfasayor, that the maidens of the daughter of Paro were walking along the shore, and she sent one and brought the baby back, and then Miriam, and then the fact that there was a nursing woman, and so on and so forth. So everybody knew that. That wasn't a secret. And she named him, even in the naming of Moshe, Kimin Amayim Mishisiu. I saved him from the water. So that was not a secret. That this Jewish child was an exception. Now, if Paro was raising him in his own household, yeah, clearly he's going to raise him for his own purposes. Why not? And this would be a brilliant thing. This kid is different, and he'll do tremendous things for Egypt. But once he saw that he was a Jew, that was the point. That's why the Pasuk puts emphasis on that. That he went out, and he saw his brothers. See, look, Vayarish Mitzri, he saw an Egyptian man, Maka Ish Ivri Me'echav, hitting a Jewish man, Me'echav, from his brothers. Now, here's a case of a superfluous word. Obviously, it's Me'echav. We know that Moshe is Jewish. So why did it have to say Me'echav? It says Vayifen Kovacho. One second. It says Vayifen Kovacho, and he looked around. Vayar Kienish. And well, the Vayachas HaMitzri, and he hit the Mitzri of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, just take a look at the previous pasuk. It says Vayigdal Moshe Vayetze Alechav. Moshe became mature and he went out to his brothers. So you already know it's his brothers. That's the first brothers. Vayar B'Sivlosam, and he saw them in their labors. Vayar Ish Mitzri Maka Ish Ivri Me'echav. Hitting a Jew from his brothers. That's two times in the same pasuk. So the second time it's Me'echav. It's Ivri. So it's clear it's Me'echav. It's already told you that. Even if it didn't mention the word once, I would have known it because he's an Ivri and he sees the other Ivrim. But the pasuk is using the word Echav twice. What's the reason for that? See, the pasuk is telling you a lot about Moshe. That, as we saw, according to the Midrash of Rabbi Bar Eloi, that Paro then was engaged in a process of trying to transform Moshe. That's, I think, what he's trying to say. He was trying to transform Moshe and to make him forget about the fact that he was an Ivri. At this point, it wasn't like a Hitlerian kind of thing where there's nothing a Jew could do to save himself in Nazi Germany because it was a racial thing. Anyone that partook of the Jewish blood, that was their ideology. But that was not the case with Paro. With Paro was the fear that the Jews were planning, we're going to expand and take over the country, that kind of thing. So that if a person were to completely assimilate and abandon the Jewish people, for you see, but they didn't kill the women. It was just the men. So the objective was to weaken them, to diminish them as a threat. So that Moshe, his objective was to transform Moshe into an Egyptian. And if that's the case, he would have nothing to do with the Jews. So the pasuk is telling you that he failed. Vayetze Alechav. He went out to his brothers. The Vayetze is a very important thing. That he still identified with them. They were his brothers. And he went out. And he went out to see the situation. That itself is a level of identification. But there's different degrees of identification. There are many people that identify with Israel or so on. Maybe they're proud, whatever the case is. That's one thing. But they're living in America, and as long as it doesn't call upon them to sacrifice anything, they identify, they're brothers. But there's a difference if someone is in trouble and needs your help, and you have to really risk everything, then the question is, do you have that level of brotherhood? That was the test. So that's why I mentioned it twice. Vayarvis of Losam, he saw them in their labors, and then he saw an Ish Mitzri Maka Ish Ivri, and I would pause at that point. He saw him hitting a Ish Ivri. Now the question is he still your brother? Or do you turn away? So the pasuk is telling you that Me'echav, that even to that extent where he had to get involved and do something and turn against the Mitzri. That is, is he going to identify on any level with the policy, with the Egypt, any sympathy towards that? He may have thought that what he was doing was wrong. You have to understand, he may have thought that what he was doing was wrong, but to kill him means that you have no use for the whole policy. You may, let's say a person more or less is in agreement with the general policy, but there's an excess, this is excessive. He may not act the same way. He may agree that, oh, it's wrong, it's excessive, but it's part of the system, and that's the system he holds from. But here, Moshe had to completely remove himself, to break away from any support. And once he did that, there was nothing left that was Egyptian in him. It was it's telling you that there was no aspect of any identification as Egyptian. He was a complete Jew. He was a complete Me'echav. And that's why when Paro heard about that, that Moshe Rabbeinu was not an Egyptian, I don't know that it's necessarily because he killed that Mitzri. Because you could ask the question, why did Paro seek to kill him? You could ask the question, there's always cases where a person, after all, he killed a particular Egyptian officer. Now, not every officer was doing the right thing necessarily. Let's say there was some kind of a system and he was being excessive. Of course, the policy was really labor. And this person was beating him excessively. So Moshe intervened. Doesn't mean that there's no way you could defend something like that. Could have defended it and said that this person was just used. You could have defended it and said that there was bad policy. The objective is to have the Jews work. What do you gain when you kill them? But when it says that he heard as a davarahu, he heard the davarahu. He heard the whole matter. I think it fits in nicely also the pshat that the Raichet gave that the. It adds a new dimension to it, because the question is, how did anybody find out about it? The only people that knew about it were Moshe and the Jew that he had saved. And it says, Vayifen ko v'cho. He didn't svayar ki einish. He saw there was nobody there. Which means there was nobody there. So then there were only two people that knew about it, and both of them had a big incentive that the word shouldn't get out. So basically it has to be Rabbi Chait said that the one that he saved told. But what does that mean? It doesn't mean he ran and snitched on him. Why would he want to do that? It means that people can't control themselves. They can't keep something secret. It's an human impossibility. The bigger, you're the only one that knows about it, and it's the most amazing thing. You got to tell somebody. Now, what people normally do is they find one person they can share it with. And absolutely, you can't tell anyone, and so on. The same thing. But now what happens is this person is now in the same position you were in. He has to tell someone. And so on and so forth. But if that's the case, if the story came from there, then the story itself, the Torah doesn't record everything, what Moshe said to the person and so on and so forth. But the story itself would contain the idea that Moshe Rabbeinu was devoted to protecting Jews. And that's what Paro heard. A davar hazeh. A davar hazeh. It's more than just the fact that Moshe killed an Egyptian. It's just the case that Moshe killed an Egyptian, so why didn't he bring him in and have a trial? And ask him. But what he heard was more than that. He heard that Moshe Rabbeinu was a Jew. And then he had to get rid of him. Then he had to kill him. Because he's a danger. He's the leader. He'll be the leader. He saw his uniqueness, all of his tremendous qualities, which were there from early on. But if it turns out that he could transform him into an Egyptian, that was his objective. And that would be a tremendous thing for Egypt. He wasn't Hitler. Hitler wouldn't do that. But he was like other anti-Semites who sought to get all the benefits of the Jew while disparaging the Jews. One way or another, they wanted the Jew to convert. And when he heard the story, he knew that that was an impossibility. That Moshe Rabbeinu was quintessentially a Jew. And then he had to kill him. Okay, so we're doing Chumash. And I just want to start with an addition to the shiur we had last Friday. I responded to Adam Kessler's question, which was a very, very interesting question, because it's the kind of thing, I like these kinds of questions, because when you read the Chumash sometimes, it's not always clear. The Chumash is not written like an editorial in one of the newspapers. It's not written with that kind of clarity, so that it's obvious from the pasuk itself exactly what's happening. Very often it's vague and ambivalent, and it's very, very challenging just to figure out the pshat. So sometimes we read a story and we just assume we know the pshat, take it for granted. In the case where Moshe went out on that day and he intervened and he killed the Egyptian and so forth, it's a very fascinating story. For many reasons, but it's clear that Moshe was concerned that Paro should find out about it, and it turned out that he did find out about it. How he found out about it is an interesting issue, but nevertheless, when he rebuked, then it says that on the second day, this is in Shemos Beis, that Moshe went out on the second day, and there were two Jewish men fighting, and he said to the Russia, "Lama sakareyecha? Why do you hit? Why would you strike your friend?" Take a look at Rashi. It's a very interesting Rashi. Lama sake. The implication is that he hadn't actually hit him yet, and that Moshe is intervening and pleading with him, so to speak. Why would you hit him? So it's not as it's not that Moshe is asking a rhetorical question, like why are you hitting your friend. It was intended. It was an intervention. It was intended to stop him. It's a statement. It's not a question. That is basically saying, don't hit him. You shouldn't hit him. Now the implication is that he hadn't actually hit him yet, because that's the point of Moshe. Moshe is not talking after he hit him. He's talking before. So Rashi says, "Al pisha lo hiko nikra rasha, maramas yad." So Rashi quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin that even though he hadn't actually hit him, he's still called a rasha, maramas yad, because of the lifting of the hand. All right, I want to return to this. Is not the issue that we discussed last week, but there's many, many points in any episode. When the Chumash is describing something, it's on many, many different levels. So, in encapsulated into the story of Moshe's intervention, so on and so forth, the Torah also conveys significant ideas pertaining to this phenomenon, which we'll come back to in a minute. I want to proceed, though. So Moshe intervened, and then apparently, this was very disturbing to them. Vayoma misam chali ish. Sar v'shofet aleinu. Who made you into a sar, a ruler, a judge, a dignitary, l'ish. Ish doesn't mean literally a man. It means somewhat of importance. It's interesting, this type of a reaction, given that we're learning in accordance with, Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Eloi's idea was that when it says Vayigdal Moshe, that Moshe grew up, so to speak. Vayigdal doesn't mean grew up. According to him, it's Midrashic, it means that Gedula, that he was, Paro appointed him to be over his house. And if that's the case, then it's also interesting, why wouldn't the Jews be afraid to be so disrespectful to him? But let's just put that aside. Then, Halargeni Ata Omer, are you planning to kill me? Kasher Haraktes HaMitri, just like you killed the Mitri. Vayir Moshe Vayomar, Achein Noda Hadavar. And Moshe was very afraid, and he said, behold, the matter is known. Or indeed, the matter is known. Then it says, Vayishma Paro Asadav HaZeh. And Paro heard this, about this, this matter. It's very, very, even the way it describes it, this is Vayivakesh Lahargis Moshe, and he sought to kill Moshe, and Moshe ran away from Paro, and he dwelled in the land of Midian, and he dwelled by the bear. But there's nothing wrong with the pasuk. It could have simply said Vayishma Paro. But what do you mean Dava Hazeh? What is the Dava Hazeh? What is the matter that it's talking about? So of course, it means that he heard about the fact that Moshe had killed the Mitzri. But it seems to be implying more. Is it just the fact that he heard the fact? Davar Hazeh seems to be Vayishma. Also, it's interesting to note, once again, the term Vayishma. Vayishma doesn't mean necessarily, doesn't only mean that when you hear something, that I, like audibly, I hear you. It's always in the sense of a deeper understanding. Vayishma means he understood. Vayishma. Shema Yisrael. It always, then later on, Vayishma Yisro. When Yisro heard, it's not telling you that Yisro heard the news. Everybody heard the news. Vayishma means that he heard, means he understood the significance of it. It's very, very interesting that it chooses to use the word Vayishma in this context. Merely to convey that Paro found out about it, that he found out about the fact that Moshe killed the Mitzri, it wouldn't have to use the word Vayishma. Because Vayishma and Dava Hazeh implies something more significant. Which, of course, is in line with what we said last week. Now, if you remember, last week I tried to approach this by raising the question about Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi. So what I said was that basically, that I think that what he's trying to explain is that Paro needed to provide a justification for the exception, so to speak, that he was making for Moshe. That Moshe was a Jewish child, and according to the law of the land, he was supposed to be executed. That was the edict. And here you have Paro himself, who made the law, would be accepting a Jewish child, making an exception, not only that, but bringing him into his own home. Now, why? See, well, because the daughter took mercy. The Torah doesn't describe the conversation she had with her father or anything like that. But put yourself in the situation. How would he justify it? Oh, because it's my daughter and because she took... So that would show how weak he is. For a ruler to set aside a very significant national policy to make an exception to purely because of the it's his daughter, and then she fell in love with his child, so he had to grant her request, that would be a big problem for him. And he would appear as a weak person. That's not the way a ruler acts. So I was sort of speculating that he sought to justify it by, to the contrary, there are these medrashim that they were afraid that there would be a Moshiach, you know, that their astrologers or whatever it is were concerned about that. However we take that, but you see that the Egyptians did have a respect or fear, a fearful type of respect of the capabilities of the Jews. Tichayos Hena. It's very, very interesting. I just thought of this idea that perhaps this will open up another thing. The midwives, the Mialdos, when they were confronted by Paro, they put forth this, they said, why didn't you fulfill my edict and kill the Jewish males? So they said that the Jewish women are not like the Egyptian women. Ki chayos heina. And there's many explanations of chayos. They're very capable, or some say like animals also, because animals give, you know, they give birth to their children very efficiently and quickly, and But the point being, however, was that they convinced them that it was impossible for them to carry out the edict, which meant that they would have to kill the babies before they even came out, so the mothers wouldn't be aware of what was going on, and they were sort of saying it was impossible, because the Jewish women are too capable, and by the time we get there, the child is already born, and thus they would know. It's very, very interesting that it seems that he bought that argument, but it would make sense, because they did ascribe tremendous powers to the Jews. The fear of the Jews, the fear that they had, which was unwarranted, there was nothing in the reality that the Jews were going to plan to take over and become a fifth column and drive them out of the land. That's more like a projection of what they would do. But you see, nevertheless, there's a respect, a fearful type of respect, projecting all of these tremendous powers onto the Jews, which is a basic hallmark of anti-Semites. So, therefore, when they used that argument of Kichayos Hena, it resonated. Because that mindset is prepared to believe, yeah, the Jews can do anything. They're different. They're different. The idea, it was a successful argument because it corresponded to, they understood the mentality of the Egyptians. That these Jews are different. They're different in every way. And the women, by the time we get there, the baby is born, and so forth. It played into that prejudice that they already had. It's not what they said was not true, in point of fact. It's not true that the Jewish women were different, and that by the time they got there, the child was already born. And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's not true. They had to make up a story because they were not fulfilling his order. And they acted with tremendous intelligence in framing that argument. That's always very, very important to understand the mentality of the individual and what his irrationalities are, and to frame an argument which is corresponds to his irrationalities. Now, of course, you're not supposed to do this when you're dealing in a normal situation. You can't deceive people. But in a case where it's a matter of defending yourself against the Russia, of course. Of course, you have to do so. So you learn something from that. So Paro, in my opinion, getting back to Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi, was able to justify it by saying that this would be good for Egypt. That obviously this was an outstanding child with tremendous capabilities, which became evident when he was very, very young. And the idea was to take one of the Jews themselves and to have him be converted, so to speak, into an Egyptian. And to the contrary, that would be much better for their program. If one of the Jews themselves is a leading personality in Egypt and he goes along with it, he doesn't protest it, so then that's even better. So the reason then to appoint him over his house would be to demonstrate that he wasn't giving into his emotions, but that this was a calculated plan which would be beneficial to Egypt. Thus, the entire thing depended upon Paro's claim that he could convert Moshe Rabbeinu. And you see that that's Vayetze. We went to the Pasuk of Echav, that the greatness of Moshe was that he did not detach himself from the Jewish people. As we said, there's two times the word Echav is mentioned. One is to show that even in that position, it's a very important, I'm expanding on that idea all week long, that it's a universal phenomenon, by the way, that not just with Jews, but all downtrodden groups, like the blacks and so on and so forth, you know, the ghetto. When somebody that's part of the group and suffering in their pain, if he should be elevated, for whatever reason, he becomes, like in America, becomes a great sports hero, whatever, a basketball star or whatever, or a politician. So then, very often, he wants to separate himself. You see, he surrounds himself, like if it's a black, he surrounds himself with whites, but he wants to gain entree into white society. So you'll see that all the people that he left behind, they get very angry at him. That he identified with them when he was part of that group. And once he became elevated, he turned his back on them. But you see that that's apparently what the Paro thought. That once Moshe Rabbeinu was honored and given a position of power in that society, so then that's it. But he didn't understand Moshe Rabbeinu. He didn't understand Moshe Rabbeinu. That this is very, very significant. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was Vayetze El Echav, that even though he was in the house of Paro, he was concerned about the Jews and their plight. There's many things we can learn from this. And that he went out to see what was going on. When you go into the Psukim, there's more specific. Very, very interesting. Because it strikes me that, Moshe Rabbeinu saw. He saw the Egyptians striking the Jew. Okay, so we don't stop. All right, so fine, he went out and he saw it. We don't see the significance of that point. There is a lot of significance in the fact that Moshe actually witnessed it. I'll tell you why, because when people go, when even during the Holocaust, when the Red Cross, whatever, international organizations went to the concentration camps, so the Germans cover it up. And you get to meet with the officials. And the officials sit down and they've prepared a whole ruse to convince you that, everything is okay and so on and so forth. The same is true with today. You go to the government officials, whatever it is, and they know how to explain things to you. But you never get to break through and to make sure. The fact that it's telling you over here that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't just go and to see what was happening. When he went to see what was happening, I'm sure he would have met with all of the local administrators, the officers. So they would probably sit down and give him a briefing. And this was an exceptional phenomenon. It wasn't the case that they were killing every Jew. This was an exceptional phenomenon. So isn't it strange that Moshe would just happen to see this? It means that Moshe did not accept that. When he went out to see, he went out to see for himself. And he wasn't satisfied with... He understood this phenomenon. That naturally, if he would go about it in the ordinary way, they would paint a happy face on it. And show how the workers are happy. And just like even the Germans, they had these bands playing, whatever it is, they could put on a show. And you could visit the concentration camp and they could put on a show and you'd walk away saying it's not so bad. Unless you were different. Unless you were determined to see for yourself. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu did not go about it in the conventional way, and he wanted to see for himself, he put himself in different positions so that he would see the fact that the... why would the Egyptian even do this in the presence of Moshe? All these things are very interesting questions. Of course he would want to hide it from Moshe. But the Torah is not giving you the particulars, but you must draw the conclusion that the fact that Moshe witnessed this tells you a tremendous amount about Moshe Rabbeinu. That when he went out to see where the labors, he was going to find out the truth. He was someone who searched for the truth, and he was not interested in any of these devices that the established authorities would use to divert him.
Hello, but it's nice.
The greatness of Moshe in Vayetze El Echav is, in my opinion, it's very much connected to the Torah. Then describes in Bamidbar, in the case of Miriam, when she spoke the Lashon Hara about Moshe, that Moshe Hay Anav Mikol Adam. The Rambam points out that the most significant virtue in terms of perfection is Anivus. And because he says of all the qualities of Moshe Rabbeinu, all of his perfections, the one that the Torah seeks to highlight is that of Anivus. And I think that's the this too is an expression of his tremendous anivus. That of course, why would a person? That's a very, very powerful emotion. That once you are part of a despised group and you're separated and elevated, so naturally you no longer identify with that group. In point of fact, you're even embarrassed. That's what you see, wealthy Jews in America.
I don't know how prominent that is today, but 20, 30 years ago, they changed their names. They'd assimilate completely. They would be embarrassed to be Jewish. It's a slight change today because in America today, ethnicity has become something of pride. So it's not because people have changed, but today everybody is flaunting his ethnicity. So if you're Jewish, that's a matter of pride. But that wasn't the case, say, 30, 40 years ago, or in the middle of the 20th century. And many Jews, many of the biggest producers in Hollywood, they all changed their names. And to, like during the Holocaust, when people would go to these people, of Jews of influence, and get them to speak out on Jewish causes, forget about it. They have a lot of that today, too, by the way. That they're very reluctant to become associated with Jewish causes, lest they be viewed as not being American. They don't want their Jewishness is not significant to them. It's something which they're not necessarily proud of. It's different today again because once the state of Israel and the factor of ethnicity and you know that's the other side of the coin. It's interesting. Yeah, when there's a Six-Day War, when the Jews are victorious and the whole world is lauding the Jews, yeah, then everybody jumps on board. Then everybody's proud to be Jewish. But when the Jews are oppressed and downtrodden, so then it's a different story. But Moshe Rabbeinu, because of his anivus, that's the anav is someone who's not interested in promoting himself. All of his energies are directed towards the service of Hashem. Lishma, because that's what he values. And really, he's not interested in pumping up his own ego. That's what it means. He's not an egotist. Everything that he's doing is based upon his desire to get closer and closer to the good. He's in pursuit of the good. He's in pursuit of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So because of that, he really doesn't need anybody's approval. So Moshe Rabbeinu didn't partake of that. See, to the contrary, as we see, when Hashem wants him to become the leader, he fights it. He refuses. He doesn't want it. All right, that's a separate story. I mean, he had reasons and so forth, but clearly it wasn't something that he desired. So Paro didn't understand that. Paro could never understand the Moshe Rabbeinu. Because the essence of Paro was ego. And to the extent where there was a self-deification. And thus, he imagined that by putting Moshe in that position of power in his own house, so that would clinch it. But he didn't understand the Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't care about that. He didn't need the approval of Paro. And he remained a Jew. He never broke that identification. Thus, these were his brothers, and he was concerned about their plight. So, that's basically the way we answered that question. But I want to add a dimension to it. Because the question was, okay, so Moshe killed the Egyptian. But why does that automatically mean that Paro was going to kill him? Because Moshe Rabbeinu was raised in his house and he had this position of power. Why wouldn't he make an inquiry? And there's always ways in which Moshe could defend himself. Because what the Egyptian was doing was wrong. He could say that I had no choice. The policy is that he's supposed to supervise them and they're supposed to be working for not to kill them. So that did not happen. So what I wanted to say was, because he didn't seek to kill Moshe because of the killing of the Egyptian. That's just another Egyptian. Who cares? But it's because he Vayishmas Adavar Hazeh means that he heard and he understood. He understood that what happened was a result of the fact that Moshe identified with his brothers. And that all of his attempts to assimilate Moshe, to transform him, had failed. Now, it's interesting, however, so we said, the fact that Moshe identified as a Jew is to be found in two incidents. One is the first incident. The fact is, and I would add that to the one of the factors, I would add that, what I said before, the mere fact that Moshe got so involved, the extent of his involvement, so that he didn't just go to have an official explanation, but actually went and made sure that he would see and find out, and he happened to see the specifics, and then he intervened and he killed the Egyptian. That showed that Moshe Rabbeinu really cared about the Jews. But then the next pasuk is also, because is the next pasuk also relevant to this? That is, on the second day there are two Jews fighting, and he says to the Russia, "Lama sakareyecha." Now I thought this is a very interesting thing. Then they rebuke him. And then obviously, it's obvious, Vayishma Parasadar, that means, that according to Rashi, that was Dasan and Aviram. And they must have told. What did they tell? Did they report merely about the fact that Moshe had smitten the Egyptian? Or did they also talk about what happened on the second day? Was that also part of the report? And if so, what would be the relevance of that? Now, it occurs to me that here, the idea that we're talking about, Rasha Loma Saka Reyecha, I would venture to say that they also reported that on the second day, Moshe intervened and rebuked them. Now, notice the rebuke, Rasha Loma Saka Reyecha. That's a Jewish idea. It's not an Egyptian idea. I don't think the Egyptians had this kind of a concept. To the contrary, they believed, I'm sure their philosophy was more that might makes right. But Moshe Rabbeinu, see, by getting involved, and that's what they said, Sar v'shofet, by rebuking two fellow Jews, he's doing something which is a Jewish thing. That shows a greater identification. Hochev tochir chasamisecha, that a Jew has a responsibility to intervene and to rebuke a fellow Jew when he's doing the wrong thing. So that's part of the Jewish way. So that's even more significant. It's one thing to get angry and kill an Egyptian, but beyond that, to implement and live in accordance with the Jewish principles. And even the idea of a Russia, that the language that he used and the way he expressed himself showed that he identifies and is living and functioning as a Jew. Then Vayishma Paras Adav Razeh. See, Paro understood. He understood from both of these cases. And the second is even more compelling. The fact that he got angry and killed an Egyptian, okay, that shows that he cares about the Jews. But the fact that he rebukes two Jews, what does he care about that for? So two Jews are arguing. Who cares? That's not his problem. That shows that he really cares. That shows that he identifies he's part of the Jewish people, and he wants the Jewish people not to be at war with each other, and there should be achdus, there should be unity amongst the Jews. And let's just take up that point for a second. Now is a good time to bring it in. I want to now take up the point. Famous Rashi, the Rambam brings it down, Lahalacha, that a person is called a Rasha from the time that he raises his hand. Even if he didn't strike him. Yet. So what's the question on this? Yeah, this seems to be, at first glance, it seems to be contrary to Judaism, to the basic idea. That is, a person, until he actually commits the deed, he's not a Rush until he actually commits the deed. That even if a person has the intention, if a person intends to rob a bank, and he doesn't rob the bank for whatever reason. Even if he gets to the bank and it's locked or whatever it is. So he's considered a thief? Or if a person intended to engage in a forbidden relationship, but he didn't. The last minute, he changed his mind or whatever. It didn't work out. So he's chayev? He's a Russia? He didn't do anything. Now, of course, it's something serious, he should contemplate and whatever, but he didn't do it. It's interesting, you see that I mentioned the case of Yosef, that he came to the house Lasos Malachto. There is a, Rashi brings it down, there is a point of view of Chazal that on that day he actually intended to engage, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, but The Chazal say that he was tempted. He was overcome by the temptation. He was going to about to give in, and then he saw Demus Diokno Shalavav. He thought about his father and what his father would think of him and so forth. And that gave him the strength to overcome it. So that, to the contrary, if a person just is preparing to do a certain deed but doesn't do it, he's a rush at that point. So here too, why would he be a rush at that point? What's the teaching over there? See, I would say that the rishus over here is not merely because you damage him. It's not based purely upon the idea of the hezek, that you, the actual wound, but rather it's the coercion. That's the derech of a rasha, of might, that he's seeking to coerce his fellow Jew purely by virtue of power, and not in terms of justice or persuasion or any of the legitimate tools, but to force your will upon a fellow Jew simply because of strength and power. That's the rishus. So of course it's worse if you actually hit him, but it doesn't matter, because once you the threat to hit him is just as compelling. So if you raise your if you want someone to do something which he doesn't really have to do, and you hit him and then he does it, so of course that's a rasha. But what the threat is just the same thing. It's the same intimidation. So when at the moment that you resort to the practice of intimidation of your chaver, it doesn't matter whether you hit him or not. That's the derech of a rasha, which is not the case, of course, in the other situations. The mere fact that you plan to rob, but until you do it, you could change your mind. Nothing happened at this point. Or the mere fact that you plan to engage in some kind of a forbidden activity. Until you do it, you could change your mind. But here, the lifting of the hand itself partakes of the rishus involved in striking a fellow Jew. So that's what I think it all fits in. And it adds a new dimension. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was rebuking his fellow Jews and was applying to them principles of Judaism, all the principles that they had inherited from the Avos, this showed more clearly that he was a Jew. This much more. The fact that he killed an Egyptian, that's significant. But here you see it being expressed, how he thinks. How he thinks and his ideas, and that he. So that's what it means, Vayishma Sadava Hazeh. And not just that he killed the Egyptian, but he heard this matter. That would be referring to this, could refer to the second case, the fact that he intervened. The fact that two Jews were fighting, and Moshe intervened and tried to persuade them by applying these concepts, which obviously they had rejected. These two Jews were Jews who assimilated, who were operating according to the Egyptian approach of might makes right. So that's Vayevakesh Largus Moshe. Now he realized that Moshe has to be killed. That Moshe is a great, great danger, to the contrary. Now that fearful respect of the Jew. Moshe was an extraordinary individual, had tremendous capability, and he sought to co-opt him. And to the, of course, they also remembered the great Jews of the past, the Yosef, Yaakov, they knew about that. And here this would be a tremendous accomplishment. He would take this Moshe Rabbeinu, who could be their savior, and to the contrary, transform him into being some great Egyptian. But that only was possible if he had the ability to uproot the Jewishness from Moshe and make him into a Egyptian, and he failed at that. So once that's the case, he has to kill him. Interesting question being raised, for haramas yad, for raising one's hand against a fellow Jew, if you didn't actually hit him, it says you're a rasha. So the question is, could you take him to court? The only reason I would, the only reason why you wouldn't take him to court is because there's got to be damages. You can't take a person to court. There's no malchus in this case, and the haramas yad is not enough to give you malchus, because it's not a violation of the lo saseh. in the Torah of Lo Yosef. That is, you're not allowed to hit a fellow Jew. Ar bar miyaken Lo Yosef. We learn it now from giving lashes that you're not allowed to add. So you can't take him to court because he didn't violate the Lo Sasa. So you can't just take a person to court for no reason. There's got to be actionable. The only thing I would say, though, it seems interesting, is let's say you did that. You did that. Is that an avera against your fellow man, which would require you to ask for mechila in order to get, when you do tshuva, in terms of the tshuva?
Right.
In other words, is there a violation of bein adam l'chavero? That we'd have to take a look at the Rambam says, because even if you verbally afflicted him, or so on and so forth. So l'chora, at first glance, I would say, if you haram ashad, if you lifted your hand against him, then that would be equivalent to verbal abuse. Shouldn't be any less, and that you would have to ask for mechila, in my opinion. At this stage, I mean, I stand to be corrected if I'm making a mistake. But on the basis of the logic of the issue, I would say, yeah, you're a Russia, and you have to do tshuva for that, definitely have to do tshuva for that, and you would have to ask for mechila.